Time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. I'm going to read out loud today from Politico, starting with the headline. Headline, Twitter's top lawyer reassures staff cries during meeting about Musk takeover. Gee, this is moving me close to tears already, but I'll try to be brave, press on, and read at least most of the article. Monday was an emotional day at Twitter, even for its executives. Shortly after billionaire Elon Musk bought the powerful social media platform, top Twitter lawyer Vijaya Gadde called a virtual meeting with the policy and legal team she oversees to discuss what the new ownership could mean for them. Gadde cried during the meeting as she expressed concerns about how the company could change, according to three people familiar with the meeting. She acknowledged that there are significant uncertainties about what the company will look like under Musk's leadership. Twitter spokesperson Trenton Kennedy said Gadde became emotional when discussing her team's impact and the pride she feels in them. Sources confirmed that she spoke at length about how she is proud of the work her team has done and offered employees encouragement, urging them to keep striving to do good work at the company. Gadde, who has worked at Twitter since 2011, is the key executive charged with overseeing Twitter's trust and safety, legal and public policy functions. She is seen internally as Twitter's moral authority and the executive tasked with handling sensitive issues like harassment and dangerous speech. Gadde played a leading role in negotiating the deal between Twitter and Musk, according to one person familiar with the dynamics. She has shepherded Twitter through some of the most contentious political battles, including the decisions to remove all public advertising and to boot former President Donald Trump from the platform in the wake of the January 6th attack on Capitol Hill, a position that has earned her devoted fans within Twitter, as well as a large contingent of right-wing critics. But as news of Musk's official takeover broke, policy and legal employees fretted at the meeting about what his leadership could mean for Twitter's carefully crafted online speech rules, including its policies against hate speech, misinformation, and even political advertising. Musk's acquisition, which places the world's richest man at the helm of one of its most influential social media networks, is one of the largest ever activist takeovers of a publicly traded company. Musk has called for Twitter to truly embrace free speech and has advocated for open sourcing Twitter's algorithm and removing all spam bots from the platform. Most significantly, Musk has signaled he supports vastly loosening the company's content moderation policies, suggesting it should only remove content if it is required by law. That would be a huge shift for the company, which has spent years creating elaborate guidelines to reduce the amount of vitriolic and threatening content on its platform. Gadde herself has advocated strongly for ensuring that Twitter's policies protect its most vulnerable users while protecting free expression, a position that is at odds with Musk's. I'm often inspired by the vigorous debates on controversial issues that occur on Twitter, but I've also been seriously troubled by the plight of some of our users users who are completely overwhelmed by those who are trying to silence healthy discourse in the name of free expression, Gad wrote in a 2015 Washington Post op-ed. At times, this takes the form of hateful speech and tweets directed at women or minority groups. At others, it takes the form of threats aimed to intimidate those who take a stand on issues. All right, folks, let me translate. In other words, she's concerned about people who don't actually suppress speech, but just say things so offensively that they intimidate others, and then as a result, Twitter suppresses the people that did the intimidation. Got that? Gad holds one of the most controversial positions at Twitter. Her teams decide how to moderate content. That's made her a target of right-wing criticism, particularly when Twitter blocked the distribution of a New York Post article about President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, in 2020. She faced a renewed wave of criticism after multiple reports confirmed she was behind the decision to ban Trump from Twitter. The billionaire entrepreneur has used the platform to attack people, often launching childish broadsides against anyone he doesn't like or agree with, said Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of the progressive tech advocacy group Free Press. And he's regularly rallied a Twitter mob of loyal fans who follow his lead with more vicious threats and bullying. Okay, my friends, this is all a lot of smoke screen and mirrors. Translation: we believe in freedom of speech so long as we agree with the speech and are not offended by the speech. Sensitive speech, responsible speech. That's more important than the so-called freedom of speech. That is what they're really saying. Catch it on? It's bullying when the right shares a viewpoint. Somebody from the left trying to shut up somebody on the right by censoring them or calling them hateful or comparing them to Nazis just because they don't believe in abortion. That, of course, is not intimidation. This is the company, Twitter. This is the company that removed Trump but allows the Taliban. Well, be of good cheer. In the wake of this information about Elon Musk, the Biden administration is setting up a disinformation board. Head of the board, Nina Jankowicz. Oh, she knows all about disinformation in as much as she is one of the outspoken who slammed the New York Post, accusing them of disinformation when they broke the Hunter Biden laptop story, a story that major news organizations have since reluctantly, kicking and screaming, admitted was true. We now know this was true. And the person calling it false, that's the person in charge of a disinformation board. But it gets better. Nina seems to have a problem with free speech. Those who advocate for free speech, she calls free speech absolutists. Oh, yeah, gotta love it. Let me read you a quote from Miss Jankowicz. I shudder to think about if free speech absolutists were taking over more platforms, what that would be like for the marginalized communities all around the world, which are already shouldering so much of this abuse, disproportionate amounts of this abuse. Marginalized, that's, again, another way of calling your opponent a racism. Yeah, if nothing else works, if you can't stand up for free speech, just call those who do stand up for free speech racists. Works every time. And now, on top of that, leftists are urging Google, Apple, and Amazon to threaten Twitter that they will be removed from their platforms unless they condemn hate speech. Translation: don't let Elon Musk make any changes. This is similar to the way they went after Parler. Wow, the things that concern the left. Criminals are being released from jail without bail. That doesn't concern them. People can walk into stores and steal up to $1,000 worth of goods without being stopped. That doesn't concern them. We have open borders. That doesn't concern them. Men can use women's locker rooms and live in women's prisons as long as they claim to identify as a woman, even after they get some of the women pregnant. That doesn't concern them. They've decimated our oil industry in order to be dependent again on countries like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. That doesn't concern them. Somebody decides to buy Twitter and open it up again for its original purpose, free speech, meaning freedom to express any point of view, even a point of view that some may not like. That concerns them. Now, just as the left is getting hysterically pessimistic, the right is getting hysterically optimistic. My friends, it remains to be seen what Elon Musk will do. Maybe he'll cave to the pressure. He describes himself not as a conservative, but as a moderate. That can mean anything these days. On the other hand, these days, even staunch self-proclaimed liberals like Bill Maher are getting fed up with the censorship. So is Elon Musk, it seems. He does seem to be a man who believes both sides should be heard. And apparently, this is a whole new idea for the snowflakes at Twitter. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious. Obvious.
You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
So, how do you like it? For years, we've been hearing about the virtues of socialism. Now it's in action. We're living under a socialist administration. No, it's not pure socialism yet, but we're fast-tracked toward getting there. And naturally, they continue to call themselves the Democratic Party, not the Socialist Party. Democratic. Right. Sure. They're about as democratic as King Henry VIII at a marriage enrichment seminar. But the man who takes a great deal of credit for pushing them that direction is Senator Bernie Sanders, who ran in the last two presidential elections. He proudly espouses socialism and is, in fact, a self-proclaimed democratic socialist. Yeah, let's hear it for Bernie. Good old Bernie, the rich need to pay their fair share, Sanders. I remember a few years ago when he was interviewed by Fox News. It wasn't a bad interview, as interviews go these days. Credit at least goes to Fox for asking real questions. Questions beyond, tell us, Senator, tell us what you really think of Donald Trump. Would you compare him more to Hitler or to Nero? Instead, they pointed out that he, too, is a millionaire. When Bernie explained that this was only because of royalties from his best-selling book, they nevertheless mentioned that under our tax law, he is allowed to pay as much as he wants. Why then, if the Trump taxes were giving too big of a break to the wealthy, did he not just personally pay more? Well, as politicians always do when they are cornered by a real honest-to-goodness question, Bernie quickly changed the subject, probably hoping nobody would notice that he was changing the subject, deflected toward Trump, and asked when his tax returns will be turned over so we can see what he paid. One question I wished Fox had asked, Mr. Sanders, whatever the president did or did not pay in taxes, he takes no salary as president. Have you done likewise as a Senator, would that not bring you as a rich man more personally toward the goal of paying your fair share? This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
This is Bob Siegel. With the wiring in your home, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. For all you know, he may have gotten his license by sending in 3 serial box tops.
Hey, these things happen. There's nothing wrong with my wiring. Houses burn down. You wanted a guarantee? You should have ordered the deluxe package.
Folks, play it smart. Call WNS Electric Incorporated. They specialize in contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I use them myself, and I wouldn't call anyone else. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric, license number 480539, WNS Electric.
People are enjoying Bob Siegel's time travel novel, Push the Winds Around. Check out these customer reviews on Amazon.com. This is one of those books, like certain movies, where you keep thinking about it long after you finished. Once I picked it up, I didn't want to put it down until I'd read the entire book. Literally, a page-turner. Every character came to life. Their personalities were well-defined and consistent. First thing I did after I finished the book was to ask about the sequel. The next customer said, "I read this book cover to cover in one sitting. Great read with completely unexpected ending that left me wishing there was just one more chapter. Give yourself a couple of hours to read it all at once because you won't want to put it down." Push the Winds Around. Available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Today, another episode of Bob's Musings on Life. You know what I'm talking about, those unimportant matters that nevertheless affect our daily living and annoy the you-know-what out of us. Have you ever been to a supermarket, noticed a really short line compared to the longer lines, and then you get into the short line, obviously, you come to realize, only after it's too late, that the line was short for a reason. The problem is the one customer in front of you. Either a credit card that will not clear, or 75 questions from the customer to the cashier. I'm telling you, they ought to put up a sign, limit, no more than 70 questions per customer. There are one or two people in line waiting to get through anyway. Or maybe it's just a price check. They take forever. Finally, you realize the line is short only because all previous customers in this line left out of frustration to find other lines. The supermarket mirage. That's what I call it. The supermarket mirage. And yesterday was the granddaddy of them all. This time, the generous store, which gives you points and rewards if you have a phone number registered with them. Well, the guy in front of me has such a number. The guy in front of me has half of his groceries already scanned, and he's the only one in front of me, which, of course, is why I took the bait. Oh, wait, the guy suddenly says, "I accidentally typed in the wrong phone number." He typed it in before the transaction was even completed, so half his groceries were scanned, the other half weren't scanned. The cashier says, "No problem," at which point he stops what he's doing. He goes to the groceries already scanned and individually rescans each and every item. The guy had about 50 items. How do I know that? I counted them. Of course I counted them. I had the time to count them. There was nothing else to do. And then there are other reasons. Sometimes I need to stop and do a price check. That takes forever. But it's heavenly. It's heavenly because heaven exists in eternity and you think about eternity while they're doing the price check. Of course, there is another reason today for long lines at stores or Starbucks or other coffee shops. The app. Yes, the smartphone special app invented to make life easier. Invented to make transactions faster. Either an app coordinating with that specific establishment or a credit card, a general credit card without the actual card being accessed through the smartphone instead. Yeah, sounds great. And I know the day is coming when that's going to be the only way we can pay. The other day I was at McDonald's going through the drive-thru. There were about five cars ahead of me. And of course, they're on the intercom. I hear every one of them. Hi, will you be paying with your app today? No. Next car. Hi, will you be paying with your app today? No. Hi, will you be paying with your app today? No, it goes on and on and on. Of course, I wasn't paying with my app either, but we will. They really want you to use those apps because they are so convenient. They make the line go faster, right? Only one problem. The line doesn't go faster, it goes slower. I do a lot of work at Starbucks. If I had a dime for every time the person in front of me was trying to bring up the app on his unstable computerized phone, well, I could open up a new Starbucks account or a new Starbucks card. Or instead of the card, I could make things simpler by downloading it as an app. Gotta love those apps. This is Bob Siegel making the apps obvious. Looking for a church that will not only challenge you, but help you to feel like a part of a family? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego near 94 in Hamishaw? I can testify firsthand to Skyline because I myself am a member. When you visit, tell them Bob Siegel sent you and ask about that free week-long trip to Bermuda for first-time visitors. They'll look at you like they don't know what you're talking about, and you will not, in fact, get any free trip to Bermuda. But you'll still be glad for a chance to experience Skyline Church. You don't want to go to Bermuda anyway. Too hot. And people who approach that area have been known to disappear. But they don't disappear at Skyline. Those who visit usually can't wait to come back.
Skyline Church.
Talk about the shortest verse in the Bible. In fact, this verse is only two words long. Jesus wept. It's found in John chapter 11, verse 35. Yeah, the shortest verse in the Bible, John 11, 35. Jesus wept. Of course, the Bible was not originally written with verses or chapters. And so when John wrote this account, he was drawing our attention to the narrative and the point of the story. Measuring the length of the verse was the farthest thing from his mind. With that in our minds, let's back up and study the context. I am reading from John chapter 11, starting with the first verse. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days, and then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." Skipping ahead a little bit. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him." Then Thomas said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." After she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Mary had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." All right, I was reading from the New International Version, so here's an interesting question. Very interesting. If Jesus knew that he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead, why was he crying? What was there to cry about? This was going to be something to celebrate, and it was going to happen within moments. Well, naturally, I'm sure part of the answer is that the sadness of Lazarus' sisters moved them despite what was going to happen. They didn't know what was about to happen, and nobody wants to see their friends sad for any reason, for any length of time. However, I believe there's another reason, a much more significant reason. Even though Lazarus was about to come back to life temporarily as a mortal, and even though Lazarus and all believers will someday rise from the dead in the final future with eternal, immortal, imperishable bodies, that's the hope for all of us, it is still a tragedy in this life to see anybody die at all, because dying was never God's purpose for human beings. Originally, God created people for the purpose of living forever, but the first human beings, Adam and Eve, turned from God, bringing sin and death into the world because God withdrew from them and the world. They went from immortality to mortality. For that reason, all of us will die. But in his mercy, God offers a second chance, a resurrection from the dead. Body, soul, and spirit can continue to live forever. Forever with God, forever with our families and friends. Heaven is not a celestial graveyard. Heaven is a real place where we continue to live out our lives, and much more happily. This hope often sounds too good to be true, but it is true. The alternative is to believe in randomness and chaos, that life is nothing but a mere accident. When we examine our hearts honestly, we realize that deep inside, none of us believe that life is a mere accident. Life has value and meaning and purpose because we were created to have value and meaning and purpose. Should you doubt this even for a moment, I suggest the perfect remedy to remove your doubts. Just think about a loved one who has died, maybe even recently. This is something I bring up when doing funeral services. It's a means of comforting the people. I say about the person who went away, think about how much they meant to you. So vital, so full of life, and you'll realize they must still be alive somewhere. That's why when you heard the news that he died, when you heard the news that she died, you had trouble believing it. No, not him, not her. That's impossible. He can't be gone. She can't be gone. And your first impulse was correct. They did not cease to exist. They went away on a trip. We wish they hadn't gone. We look forward to someday taking the same path, the same journey, so we can see them again. This comforting hope does not erase sadness, of course, but hope sustains us through the sadness. We know that because of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, his resurrection from the dead, and his atonement for all of our sins, that all who gave their lives to the Lord are with the Lord right now. Toward the end of Jesus' time on earth, he had an interesting discussion with his disciples, those people who had been following him around for 3 years. I'm reading from John 14, the first 7 verses. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way? Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. So those were the words of Jesus, but there was also a man who was not a disciple of Jesus, at least not at first. For him, it took an encounter later with the resurrected Christ. This man is known to us today as Paul the Apostle, who wrote about half the books of the New Testament. Many years after meeting Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, Paul wrote to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15, starting with verse 54. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? Make no mistake, your loved one is alive. A different kind of life, but life nevertheless. In fact, a better kind of life. They no longer suffer. Never again will they feel pain for all of eternity. And they'll be alive for all of eternity. They are with God. They're in a better place. We still mourn because we miss them, but at least we can look forward to seeing them again on a day when there will be no more want, no more anguish, no more discomfort, no more loneliness, no more disease, no more evil, no more death, no more loss. And what could be more wonderful than that? What is life like in heaven? Some of that we're never going to be able to answer this side of heaven in this life, but God has left us clues because we've all experienced a taste of heaven in this life. Imagine the most beautiful place you've ever seen, the prettiest forest or the most majestic beach, the most breathtaking sunset. And then imagine the warmest, most loving experience you've ever had with family or friends. Multiply these feelings and images by about 10,000, and you have just a small, microscopic taste of heaven. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
The sequel to The Dangerous Christmas Ornament is called Inside the Castle in the Glass, And already this entertaining sequel is getting great reviews from customers on Amazon.com. Reviews such as this one. Very clever way of introducing certain life principles in a fictional setting. I thoroughly enjoyed the story. Here's another review. I picked up this book at a book signing with Bob Siegel on a Friday. By Monday morning before work, I finished it. This is over 500 pages of story. I couldn't put it down. I would plan to put it down at the end of the chapter, then something big would take place. I would have to continue to see what happened. A lot of unexpected twists and turns and a lot of things you can't imagine. Things that make you say, what? By the way, I am pushing 60 years old and I enjoyed this book and look forward to more of Bob's books. Keep them coming. Inside the Castle in the Glass, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Always good to be with my producer, Brendan Thomas. Brendan, what's on your radar today?
Well, Bob, let me first off say, I couldn't agree with you more on your monologue about Twitter with Elon Musk. Now, I am very happy that he's going to be owning it and he's saying these words about this is actually true freedom of speech and everything like that. But I agree with you. I'm very skeptical
wait,
still.
Take a wait and see attitude.
Exactly.
Because sometimes people talk tough and then they cave. The Republicans do it every time they win an election.
You beat me to the punch. Darn it. Every time. All right. Well, we're in part four of Bible questions tonight.
Okay.
So my first question is a quite interesting one, I would say. As Christians, we believe that people who will reject God will spend their eternity in hell. Why does God create those people still? That's a simple, very yeah. controversial question.
Yes. Well, it's a very good question. Paul actually raised that question or acknowledged that it's a question in Romans chapter 9, and he gave two answers. The first answer was, who are we to question God and we don't know? Okay.
That's fair enough, too.
And then we talked last week about Paul giving his opinion, but after he said that, he's going, but let me throw something out here.
Okay.
And he suggested that God allowed everybody, both those who are going to accept him and those who don't, so that those who are going to accept him can kind of be tested and chiseled and fashioned by the others, the iron meeting iron, so to speak. That was a suggestion that Paul made. The truth is, on the bottom line, we still have to call it a mystery. But once again, whatever God's reason was for doing that, none of those people will be able to stand before God and say, hey, it wasn't my fault. If you didn't want me in hell,
bad.
Why
my
did you cream?
My bad on this one. My bad on this.
Yeah, what they're going to do is they're going to have to admit that they could have chosen to accept Christ if they'd wanted to. So that is the bottom line. They could say, okay, if you knew I wasn't going to accept Christ, why did you create me? That's a very interesting question, but God's going to say, whatever the answer is, you still could have accepted Christ. And that is the bottom line.
Okay, fair enough. It's a really interesting question. And
it is. Yeah, I can understand somebody asking that.
Yeah, definitely a lot of atheist people will say that too out there. Like, oh, why am I here then?
Atheists will throw out everything but the kitchen sink.
Exactly,
but I don't know if you've heard, I did a whole series of podcasts, and I've done them on the radio too, of how atheists live as though there's a God, even though they're constantly denying
it. Exactly.
They live as though there's value and meaning and purpose and right and wrong, and none of those things could be true if there was no God.
Absolutely. Okay, so on to the next question. Does the Bible say anything about infant baptisms? And should churches continue this practice? Now, I personally was baptized as an infant as well, so I was...
Yes, you came out of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, exactly. So, what is your opinion on this matter, and does the Bible say anything about...
Okay, well, let me say, first of all, that this is unfortunately one of those matters that divide churches, and I don't think they should.
I agree.
If I was pastoring a church, and I have pastored churches, when people came and they had a different... I do not baptize infants myself. I do not believe that the Bible condones that practice. However, if somebody was baptized as an infant, I can still be your friend. Okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't think we should split churches over it. But to get to the technical question, what baptism originally meant was a way of somebody proclaiming their dedication to Jesus Christ. It was meant to be a conscious decision. The reason people started baptizing infants is they started freaking out, like, well, what if the baby dies before he's old enough to make a conscious decision? And they thought that by baptizing the baby, they were kind of putting a protective covering over him. Now, that may have been well-intentioned and their hearts may have been in the right place. But along with that theology, we would have to believe in a God who would send an infant to hell. A loving God would not send an infant to hell. And the Bible makes it very clear that infants and even little children have no understanding of right and wrong. I mean, I know little kids as they develop, Johnny, don't steal the apple.
Of course. Yeah.
But I mean,
but those are like common sense
stuff. But they're not.
In terms of more complicated issues, they have no clue. Exactly.
God does not hold little children accountable for good and evil, and certainly a baby who can't even talk yet and doesn't know much what's going on except that he wants his bottle. So the idea that God would have sent those babies to hell had they died, that's the idea that came behind infant baptism. Now, the Catholic churches and the covenant churches, they do have another sacrament called confirmation where they try to replicate the original idea of somebody's baptism being a conscious decision. So what people will do at their confirmation is they'll say, okay, I now personally add my assent to my baptism because that was not my choice then, but I'm making it my choice now.
Which that happened to me, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes, I have been confirmed. So,
and
yes.
That's not the way the Bible says to do it, but if somebody does it that way, that's fine. If I lead somebody to Christ, I'm going to encourage them to get baptized. If somebody is brought up in some other kind of tradition, God doesn't give us a theology exam on Judgment Day. So it's not one of those things where I think churches have to divide over. But since you asked, biblically, we don't see the practice of infant baptism going on.
So that does lead to a few more questions that
sure.
aren't even on my other questions.
Go right ahead.
So is rebaptism okay then or no? In that case, no.
I've had people ask me that. There's one baptism that God wants us to have. There are times when people say, well, I got baptized when I was a teenager and I think it might mean more to me now. My wife, when we were in Israel, she wanted to get baptized again because we were at the Jordan and she wanted to get baptized right where John the Baptist
and that's
was
a, that's a lifetime
yeah,
experience.
Yeah, now I didn't feel the need to get rebaptized. On the other hand, I was one of the ones that was baptizing people in the Jordan and I thought that was pretty cool. I got the privilege of baptizing my wife. The one that counts, the one that was most important to God, obviously, was the one that she did after she became a Christian. But was there something wrong with her getting baptized again? Of course not. I don't think it's a big deal.
Are there some churches that say it's a big deal?
Oh, there would be some churches. You can run the gamut on the big deals churches.
Yeah.
And some churches will say you're not saved until you're baptized. Some churches will say you're not saved until you're baptized in our church. If you were baptized in another church, it doesn't even count.
I have heard that too before.
Okay. There's just all kinds of barriers that have been put up over this practice. I look at baptism and its relationship to salvation like the relationship between a marriage vow and a wedding ring. Okay, your wedding ring is not what marries you. What married you was you made a vow before God and before your wife.
Yeah, the ring is just symbolic.
Well, can you imagine turning to your wife and saying, now I'm committed only to you and I've made a vow, but I think I'm going to just not wear my wedding ring when I go into singles bars.
Yeah, no.
And she's going to say, well, wait a minute. If you really made the vow,
then
the ring is just showing what the vow is. So it's like, does baptism save us? No. But on the other hand, if somebody is saved, what would be their reason for refusing to get baptized? So that's another way to put that question.
But it is a big step in your religion as well, getting baptized. So that's...
Yeah. It is, but some churches, see, like now in the Catholic Church, they'll say the baptism of the infant removes the penalty for original sin. And then there are other churches, including the Eastern Orthodox Church, that they believe in baptismal regeneration. I don't believe in that. I believe you're saved. If somebody got saved on a Monday and they were going to get baptized on a Tuesday and they got into a car accident and died, they'd still go to heaven.
Yes, in that case, yeah.
Right, but whereas I don't believe baptism saves you, I do believe baptism is a very important test of your faith to see if you really had been saved.
Okay. Going back to your original statement about how children don't really understand, and so therefore they don't really...
Not to the point where they're held accountable before God.
Exactly.
Obviously, as they grow, they're starting to understand right and wrong. That's why parents are there to raise them.
I do remember a couple of Bible verses where the child actually gets the sin because of their parents specifically. So what is the complication of that situation?
Well, there are some verses that people have taken out of context and haven't understood the culture. For example, one story that comes to my mind, I don't know if it's the one you were thinking of, but in the book of Joshua, there was a man named Achan who had committed a sin, and because of his sin, Israel was losing the war. So they lined him up and his whole family, and they stoned them to death, and that included his children. But you need to understand, in those days, people lived in clans. A, his children could have been adults, and B, I assume that the entire family participated in the sin and that they were not punishing the entire family just for what the father had done. Because when you get to the book of Ezekiel, it's made very clear, God says, sons will not be put to death for the sins of their fathers, and fathers will not be put to death for the sins of their sons. For a person's own sin, he will live and die. So the Bible's very clear. So it's interesting, the Bible does have the reputation of a God who punishes children for the sins of their fathers, but the Bible's teaching is actually the opposite of that.
Okay, gotcha. So I just took it out of context, probably. So
many take it out of context. And it's very understandable, because when we just read it without an understanding of the culture, it does seem to read that way. And who has the time to go and stop and study the culture all the time?
No,
so it's very understandable.
But this is a good learning situation for me here.
Sure, so, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, so let's go into another question. In the Old Testament, how were Gentile followers of God saved? Were they supposed to become Jewish in order to be saved?
Okay, very good question, because that comes up a lot. If we're saved only through Christ, how were people saved before Jesus came?
That's correct.
And as you just acknowledged, part of the answer, if you go back to ancient Israel, no, they didn't understand that a man named Jesus was going to come and die for their sins, but they knew they were sinful. They knew there needed to be an atonement for their sin, and they made animal sacrifices. We learn in the New Testament that the blood of the bulls and the goats and the sheep did not really atone for those people. When Jesus died on the cross, he was paying for the sins of Moses, Abraham, King David, King Solomon, because they did understand they were sinful. They knew they needed an atonement. How were Gentiles in those days judged? Would they have had to become Jewish to get saved? No. Paul actually answers that question. We can read that in Acts 17. Paul is on Mars Hill talking to Greek philosophers, and they had a statue up there that said to an unknown God. Now, there was kind of an ironic, somewhat humorous, but somewhat sad story behind that. There had been this huge plague that had wiped out a lot of people in Athens. Mm-hmm. They were afraid they'd made the gods angry. So they put up plaques to every Greek god they could think of. And then they put up one to an unknown god just in case there was one they didn't know about or never heard of or missed. Well, Paul, seeing that, he seized upon it. He says, you have this plaque to an unknown God. I'm going to make this God known to you. Now, Paul knew that this unknown God was the one and only real God, but that's where he started. He started where they were at. But then he goes on and he explains the gospel, and he said something very interesting. He said, the times of ignorance God has overlooked, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent. So that tells us that no, those Gentiles were not expected to know the God of Israel. Now, when the Bible says that God will overlook somebody's ignorance, that doesn't mean that being ignorant gives you an automatic ticket into heaven.
Yes.
We're told in Romans 2 that we have a conscience, and God will judge people through their conscience. We're told even somebody, right in Romans, we're told even somebody who's never read a Bible, God's law is right in their conscience. On Judgment Day, it says their conflicting thoughts will accuse or perhaps excuse them. Their conscience is bearing witness.
Huh.
So imagine this, Brendan. Let's say somebody's conscience is bothering him, and he says, boy, to whatever God is out there, and I don't even know your name, but I'm a sinner, and I need to be forgiven, and I also want to overcome my sin, but I don't see how, because my thoughts are my thoughts. That is obviously somebody we can see who, if he'd heard the gospel of Jesus, would have responded. Then you have other people. They don't pay any attention to their conscience at all. They go, oh, well, everybody does this. It's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so two people can stand before God on Judgment Day, and God will say, okay, neither one of you ever heard of Jesus, but Jesus still died on the cross for both of you. However, you are somebody who obviously would have accepted Jesus had you heard the gospel, and you are somebody who obviously would not have accepted Jesus, even if he'd heard the gospel. So that's how I believe God judges the sincerely ignorant. Those who are sincerely ignorant, he judges them according to what he knows they would have done if they had heard. And to show them he's not speculating, he can play back the automatic tape right in their own conscience, and they'll hear themselves condemning their own actions throughout their lives.
I like that idea, actually. I really do. I never was taught that, I guess, growing up. So
That's what we do here on the radio.
Exactly.
We teach a lot of things that nobody else teaches.
Exactly.
Why be on the air if you're not going to do that?
All right. Well, we only have time for one more question.
Okay.
So this last question is, I heard the New International Version skips some verses in Acts, and we were just talking about Acts. Is that true? And if so, why are they skipped exactly?
Well, it's not just in Acts. We need to first go back and understand that when we get into the science called textual criticism is the acknowledgement that all literature from the ancient world, whether it's the Bible, whether it's Greek philosophy, Roman history, whatever it is, we have it all in the form of copies. We don't have the originals because in those days, the papyri that they wrote on, it didn't survive. And you couldn't save it on your hard drive. If you were going to have something last and preserve it, you had to keep copying it. Now, in time, they had a whole new different kind of paper called parchment and vellum, which was made with animal skin. And so the copies that have finally survived were written on those. But we have copies. Now, in the New International Version, sometimes in the footnotes, they'll say the oldest and most reliable manuscripts omit this verse. And so they'll omit it too. Sometimes they'll write the verse in the margins. Other times they'll put the verse in the narrative. They'll put it there, but they'll still tell you that it didn't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are other scholars who do other translations, and it doesn't matter to them what the oldest text said, because they would say that the oldest text is still a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to see what's in the majority of the texts, because they feel that if it made it into the majority of the texts, it's more likely that the original text said that. So that's an argument that scholars have. Some prefer majority text. Some prefer older text. I'm a little more inclined to go by majority text myself. But the truth is, those verses in dispute are very few, and they make no material outcome to the Bible. They're not of that great of an importance, but that is one of the reasons why the New International Version will at times omit certain verses.
I got you. I do remember reading in the Bible once where it had a note saying, like, yes, this was in Leviticus. Oh, Leviticus, yes,
yeah.
Chapter 11. And I remember, because I remember that specific one. I don't remember the verses, but it mentioned that a bat was a bird, and they made a note saying, yes, we know that bats are not birds, but at the time they were thinking they were birds.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
but that's another story.
Yeah, they'll put little notes like yeah, that.
Yeah, exactly.
In there,
well,
right.
Thank you so much again. We have plenty of other Bible questions.
These are great. I love answering Bible questions, so keep them coming.
Absolutely. So stay tuned, listeners, for part 5 at some
all
point.
Right,
so.
All right. And next week we will have Jim Barrier on, so get your stump
another
Jim
stump
Barrier.
Jim.
And he'll be in the studio next week.
Oh, really? So, oh, yes. Sweet. So a live in studio.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. We'll see you next time, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.